say, take Jerusalem, $12.99. No. No, he didn't do that either. So I'll talk about that. So there are tons of books that have used or have said things about the Knights Templar. We've got Ivanhoe, Da Vinci Code, Umberto Eco, and it is Foucault's Pendulum. How many people here have read Ivanhoe in school? All right, I will tell you, Sir Walter Scott did the Templars wrong. All right, and I'll talk about that. Everything he said was, he just made things up. He made things up about who the Templars were. He made up the name of the Grand Master. He made up everything about what the Templars do. In Ivanhoe, they had a woman. Oh, we'll have her burned at the stake for being a witch. No, the Templars had nothing to do with that. So he was kind of conflating these things with the Inquisition and just say, okay, Templars. Okay, we'll just make things up and make them the villains. And it was all wrong. So what else did we have? Dan Brown, Lost Symbol, Assassin's Creed, computer game, had a lot of information about the Templars. They tried pretty hard to get accurate, but of course it was a fictional story. So I'm going to talk a little about the Da Vinci Code. So in the beginning of the book, they have this little quote saying, all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. No. So I'm going to try, and it's going to be a little bit complicated because I'm going to be talking about things that are fiction and things that are fact. So what I've tried to do is when you see it in italics, that's wrong. It didn't happen that way. And then when it's not in italics, that's the accuracy. So Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown got his information from a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail that was published in 1982 by Bagent Lee and Lincoln. And they said in that book, quote, the Priory of Sion is a real organization that was founded in 1099 and had a series of grandmasters, including Leonardo da Vinci. Italics. Wrong. Didn't happen that way. So also in this book, and according to Da Vinci Code, the Priory of Sion, they said, that was founded in 1099, had a series of secret grandmasters over the years, and the Priory of Sion founded the Knights Templar as their military arm, and there were documents verifying that the Priory of Sion did this, because these documents were found in a pillar in a church in France in the 1800s by a priest named Béranger Saunier. None of this is true, but this is what they said. So in reality, Knights Templar, they were a group of warrior monks. They existed for a couple hundred years during the Crusades, and they were massive. They were involved in every aspect of European society for 200 years. Think of them like the first multinational corporation. They were involved in battles, and they were involved in finance. Those were the two main things that they were involved with. They had fortresses, which they built during the Crusades, all up and down the Middle East here, with what is now Israel, and then you have the island at the top left, that's Cyprus. And most of these fortresses were then torn down as the forces, especially the forces of Saladin, came in. Saladin, amazing man. I wish I could have met him. So the founder of the Knights Templar, this is truth, okay? There's a man named Hugh de Payon, and he was a veteran of the First Crusade. And he had relatives, Godfrey of Saint-Omer, and all of them came from this same area of France. Because what had happened was, the First Crusade, and the Christians come in and they take Jerusalem. It was a bloody mess, very questionable about the ethics of the whole thing, but that's a whole different talk. So the Christians go in, they take over Jerusalem, and now that the Christians are in Jerusalem, a bunch of Europeans are going, cool, Jerusalem has been taken over, I'm going to go see it. I want to go see the holy places. So they would come in ships to the Holy Land, and Jerusalem is not a city on the ocean, it's a landlocked city. So the Europeans would come in to the coast of the Holy Land, and they would have to travel overland to Jerusalem, and they were getting slaughtered. There were bandits everywhere, because look, there's all these pilgrims coming, and they got money. And so they were going, and they were killing these pilgrims, and it was a really difficult and bloody mess. So Hugh de Payon suggested to the new Christian king of Jerusalem, how about we set up a new set of monks that will be warrior monks, and we will protect these pilgrims as they're traveling overland? And the king of Jerusalem, the Christian king of Jerusalem, said, great idea. come on in, I will give you your headquarters, which will be on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Now, the Temple Mount, some of you may recognize this, is, will my mouse work? No. Okay. So, the building with the gold dome is what's called the Dome of the Rock. This was built by the Muslims, and when they were when they had the city, and then this gray building at the lower right, at the lower right is what's called Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is known as the farthest mosque. It has to do with a story told about Muhammad. So King Baldwin gave the Templars that lower mosque with the gray dome and said, use this as your headquarters. So the monks, Hugh de Payon, they set up there and they used it as a stable for their horses and their headquarters. Now a little bit more about that golden dome. There's the rock inside of it. And this rock was holy in multiple religions. It was the holiest site in Judaism. It was where God gathered the dust to create Adam. This whole Temple Mount was the location of the Temple of Solomon. It was where the Ark of the Covenant was kept. It was referred to several times in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. It was also a sacred place for Muslims. So they called it the Noble Sanctuary, and it was the third holiest site, is the third holiest site in Islam. So there's a story called, for the Muslims, it's called the Isra, I may be pronouncing this wrong, Isra and Miraj, which was in 621, the year 621, Muhammad, who was resting in Mecca, fell asleep, and then a great lightning steed came to him. It was a steed that had sort of the body of a horse and the face of a woman. And it was called the lightning steed. It traveled as fast as lightning across the heavens. And this lightning steed, which was called the Burak, and if you know anything about current Muslim countries, there is an airline currently called Burak Airlines. So this lightning steed took Muhammad to the area which is now the Temple Mount. And then Muhammad dismounted from the Burak, and he prayed. And then in the story, Isra Miraj, he prayed, and he called this area the farthest mosque. Now, none of these buildings were there at the time. And the farthest mosque doesn't say, was it in Jerusalem? Was it somewhere in what is now Saudi Arabia? But modern scholars say, oh, it's probably Jerusalem. You know, they're kind of making a guess. So Muhammad, after he dismounted from the Burak, he then went up into heaven, in the various circles of heaven, and he met other prophets. He met Moses. He met Jesus. And he went up and up and up and up, and he met God. And God told Muhammad, go back down to the people and tell them to pray 50 times a day. And so Muhammad then comes down through the circles and he meets Moses again. And Moses says, hey, what did God tell you? And Muhammad says, well, he told me to go down to the people and tell them to pray 50 times a day. And then Moses says, no, they'll never do it. Go back up. Ask for a reduction. So This is the story. So Muhammad goes back up and he talks to God again, and he comes back down. He talks to Moses. No. Go back up. Ask for fewer. So they go back and forth and finally come down, and Moses says, okay, that'll work. And then Muhammad comes back down with the instructions that all Muslims should pray 3 times a day. Okay? So then he gets back on the Burak. Muhammad gets back on the Burak, and he goes back to Mecca, and he tells everyone, and there are doubters and disbelievers, and this is all part of the legends of Islamic history. So this later on, the Muslims came back and kicked the Christians out of Jerusalem. So this was, no buildings were there at the time, but the Muslims came in and kicked the Christians out, and then they built buildings. So they built this mosque, this gray mosque, and they called it Al-Aqsa Mosque, the farthest mosque, after the story. Okay, so we're trying to get the timeline. So in 621 was the Isra Miraj, the night journey. Then in 637, Rashidun Caliph Umar comes in. He builds the gold one, the Dome of the Rock. And also then the Abbasid caliphs come in, and they add this new gray mosque, which they call Al-Aqsa Mosque. Then 1099, the Crusaders come in, and they capture the city. And then 1187, Saladin comes in, and he takes it back. But in modern stories, many people look at that gray mosque and they say, oh, That's the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the farthest mosque. That must have been where Muhammad went and prayed, because they said Muhammad went and prayed at the farthest mosque. So we have this confusion about the years, all right? So this happens also with the Templars. So anyway, this again is the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which was built in 705, captured by the Crusaders in 1099, and this was the Templar headquarters. Truth. This is the headquarters of the Knights Templar from about 1119 to 1187, and then the Muslims came in and kicked them out, and things went on with the Crusades. And again, this is just one more picture. Again, Gold Dome, Dome of the Rock, Gray Dome, Al-Aqsa Mosque. So this idea of a group of monks carrying swords was kind of a new thing. And there were a lot of Europeans that weren't crazy about this. And they said, no, you can't have a group of monks that are warriors. And but then they had a really powerful protector named Bernard de Clairvaux, who's now Saint Bernard de Clairvaux, as the dogs, right? Saint Bernard de Clairvaux, and he wrote really powerfully on their behalf. And he would say, for example, a Templar knight is truly a fearless knight and secure on every side, for his soul is protected by the armor of faith, just as his body is protected by the armor of steel. He is thus doubly armed and need fear neither demons nor men. So the Europeans, they kind of like this. And so they had a council to discuss it. This was the Council of Troyes in 1129. And the Templars were officially approved as an authentic charity. All right. So now anyone in Europe that wanted to donate money to the Crusades, and they didn't want it to be wasted, they didn't want to send it to a fake charity. We have those issues today as well. But they knew that the Knights Templar were an authentic approved charity. So tons of money started going in, right? They had money was given, huge tracts of land for anyone who has heard that. Huge tracts of land were given to the Knights Templar, and sons of noble families were also sort of given to the Templars to become a Templar, because this was a big deal. This was a very honorable profession to be a Templar. So now they were monks, and they had a rule also designed for them by Saint Bernard de Clairvaux, which was very similar to another set of monks he'd founded, which was the Cistercian order. And if you heard of Galahad and the rules that Galahad had to live by, this was very similar to what was done at the time. They had a logo. This logo, the seal of the Templars, was two knights on a single horse. And this was to say that they were very poor knights, and so they could only afford one horse for every two knights, which wasn't really true, but this was their logo. And around the edge of it, it says, and I don't know if anyone here speaks Latin. Anyone here speak Latin? Greek? Okay, so you won't know if I'm right or wrong. Sigillum Militum Christi, or Expisti, which was Sigillum Seal, Militum Soldiers, and Christi Christ. This is the seal of the soldiers of Christ. So the popes really liked them and said, so there was a papal bull, which was an official document, and these documents were all named today by the first three words in it. So this was 1139, Omne Datum Optimum, which said the Templars are now exempt from all local laws. They don't have to pay border taxes. Nothing's going to slow them down. They could go through every border. They don't pay taxes. They only answered to the Pope. So this was sort of cool in some ways, but there was also local nobles that were going, what? And so there was some friction that was going on. So a little bit more just about the Templars. They had different divisions. There were the knights, who had to be from knightly descent. They wore white robes with a red cross. Then there was another class, lower, which was the sergeants and warriors and craftsmen, and they wore black robes or brown robes. And then there was also a division that was the clergy. The warriors, they were funded, okay? They had the heaviest armament of the day. And they were funded, they trained, they had good armor, they had good weapons, they had good horses, the horses were well-trained, the horses were well-armed. They were like the main tanks of the day. And so when there was a battle, and they got together, and they would get together, and they would charge at the enemy lines, the enemy would get out of the way, okay? Because these Templars were such heavy warriors. They also fought. They didn't surrender. They didn't surrender until the flag had fallen. They would keep fighting to the last man. They had one master in each region around Europe, so France, England, Portugal, and then there would be a grand master who was over the entire organization. Generally a lifetime appointment, though, because they were all fighting, this could be a fairly short appointment from time to time. The grand master was the one that kind of was over the entire organization. So the Templars were all over Europe. This is the Templar Church in London. If you're in London, you can go and visit it. You can see this pillar on the right-hand side at the top, two knights on a single horse. They did round buildings, which were based after one of the buildings in Jerusalem, which was the Holy Sepulchre. So they did have an initiation ceremony, which was held in secret, and they had to take vows of chastity and piety and poverty and obedience while they were Templars. So if you go to London and you see things named Temple, these are probably remnants of the Knights Templar. So the Temple Tube Station is from the Knights Templar. And there's also the Temple Gate, which is where, I believe, lawyers, the law schools in London. They also originated the idea of banking because they were trying to protect these pilgrims that were traveling from Europe down to Jerusalem. And so rather than have these pilgrims carry all their wealth with them, which just made them targets, they initiated the idea of a letter of credit. So a pilgrim would hand over some valuables to the Templars in London or in France. The Templars would give them a letter of credit. The pilgrim would carry that letter of credit with them to Jerusalem, would show it, and then would be able to get their funds in Jerusalem. So this made the pilgrims less of a target. So the Templars kind of initiated banking. As they were. They also, pilgrims, when they went to Jerusalem and they had businesses in England or France or whatnot, and they're like, who's going to run my business? Well, they'd ask the Templars, can you run my farm? Can you run my vineyard? So the Templars had this reputation as well. Also, if someone was like saving wealth for their retirement, right? And they who do you give it to that will guard it? Okay, the Templars, because the Templars were, you know, they were good people, you know, very rule of law kind of people. So they guarded valuables. They guarded different assets. And, of course, they were involved in the battles. So this was one of the battles at the bottom left, the Battle of the Horns of Hattin in 1187. And this is a picture, again, of the Muslim leader Saladin. Very noble, very ethical individual. He wasn't about killing Christians. He was about retaking the lands. And then once the lands were taken, he allowed the Christians to come in. As long as everyone kind of was cool about it, he would allow them in. So that's just something to keep in mind. It wasn't that the Muslims were just killing Christians left and right. So the Christians, the Jerusalem was lost in 1187. So the Templars and everyone kind of retreated and eventually they were pushed off the entire mainland to the island of Cyprus, where the Templars had their headquarters there in Cyprus. So with the crusade kind of lost at this point, some of the leaders in Europe were kind of like, do we really need the Templars anymore? And Philip was heavily in debt to the Templars at this point. He'd borrowed immense amounts of money from the Templars because of his wars, I believe his wars with England. And he was like, okay, we don't really need the Templars. Maybe if we just get rid of the Templars, then he doesn't have to owe them any more money. And Philip was about this. He believed that he was more powerful than anyone, more powerful than the Templars, more powerful than the Pope even. He wanted to do what he was going to do. And so when the Pope at the time, this was Pope Boniface VIII, was telling Philip that he needed to chill out, Philip kidnapped that pope. He bullied the pope, Boniface VIII, and he kidnapped him. And the guy was an old man, and, I mean, the people rose up, and they went and they rescued Boniface VIII, but, I mean, from the shock, he died a few months later. So, you know, the normal thing, the cardinals go into conclave, and they choose a new pope, Benedict XI, and he dies after a few months under suspicious circumstances. So it's believed that Philip had him poisoned. So the cardinals go back into conclave. They're in conclave for a year, okay, trying to choose a pope. And who are we going to pick? Because King Philip is probably going to take the guy out. So they finally chose a French pope, someone who had been a childhood friend of Philip's. This is Pope Clement V, all right? And he moved the papacy from Italy to France. It was in southern France. So if you remember anything from history about the Avignon papacy or the Babylonian captivity of the papacy, this was that. This was when Philip had a pope that was really under his thumb. So Philip tells the pope, disband the Templars. And Philip arranges for all the Templars in France to all be arrested on the same date. So October 13th, 1307. All across France, Templars are arrested, and their assets are confiscated by King Philip. So other leaders in Europe, they're scandalized. Well, what the heck? Philip, what are you doing? This is the Knights Templar. And they said, okay, well, let's have trials. And Philip starts charging with the Templars with all these things about, well, they're heretics, you know, they're devil worshippers. They pee on the cross. These are actual charges that he was saying. These were the same things he'd been saying about the Pope that he'd kidnapped, right? And so there was a set of trials, and the Templars at the time were tortured, and they were tortured into false confessions. And these were all, again, very similar charges to what had been done with the Pope. So Pope Clement does have a little bit of power left, and he issues a papal bull called Pastoralis Praemunente, and he says, okay, arrest all Templars in Europe and seize their assets, and then give those assets to one of the other orders. Give them to the Knights Hospital, Hospitalet. And so there are some trials, and one of the Templars, he's got some legal training, you know, he had some education, and he said, well, I want to see the evidence for these trials. So King Philip says, burn them at the stake. And anyone that tried to defend themselves was burned at the stake. These were dozens of Templars burned at the stake, May 12, 1310, to keep them from testifying in the trials that the Pope had ordered. So Pope Clement finally, he says, okay, disband the Templars and give all their assets to the Knights Hospital. So other countries in Europe, some of them, they have trials, and of course the Templars aren't found guilty of anything. In some places, the Knights Templar simply changed their name from Knights Templar to Order of Christ, and they said, okay, we're not Knights Templar anymore. So the last Grand Master of the Knights Templar, this is Jacques de Molay, and he was arrested with all those other Templars that were arrested on October 13th. He was tortured, he was forced to confess, then later he recanted, and this went back and forth. And after 7 years in prison, and he's about age 70 at this point, he finally says, no, I recant my confession, I am a Templar, and King Philip threatens him with being burned at the stake, and Jacques de Molay says, no, I am a Templar. So King Philip has him burned at the stake. This is in 1314. This is in an island in the River Seine in Paris. Jacques de Molay was burned along with one of his Templar associates, Geoffrey de Charnay. And according to legend, Jacques de Molay called out from the flames that both King Philip and Pope Clement would soon meet him before God. So again, he's burned at the stake on March 18, 1314. April 20th, 1314, Clement, 50 years old, suddenly dies. Okay. November 29th, 1314, Philip, age 46, is on a hunt and suddenly dies of a stroke. All right? And it goes on. Going on to his king, his son, Louis X, age 26, dies after playing tennis in 1316. So it goes on to his next son, Philip V, 29 years old, gets sick, dies, 1322. His next son, Charles IV, 33 years old, dies in 1328. So the entire Capetian line, gone. All right. Now, there's all sorts of battles for the throne. Some of you know Game of Thrones, there's a lot of battles for these thrones. And some of this is sort of based on this, because there's now disagreements on who should be on that throne between France and England. This is something you may have heard of, the Hundred Years' War. All right? After the Hundred Years' War, we have, anybody? Wars of the Roses come in. All right? And after that, we have King Henry VIII, six wives, cutting heads off. So you can sort of see that this thing with the Templars was a massive event that led to many other events in Europe. So what happened to the rest of the Templars? Some tried, virtually none were convicted, some were pensioned, they just retired, they were absorbed into some of the other orders, or as I said, in Portugal, they just changed their name. For example, if you go to Portugal, this is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, the Castle Tomar. So that's kind of the fact of what happened with the Templars. They were gone, early 1300s, or kind of absorbed. So a little bit about the fact and fiction. Friday the 13th is not because of the Templars. Yes, they were all arrested on a Friday. That was the 13th, but that is not the origin of the Friday the 13th legend, because you can go to like an 1800s, a dictionary of phrase and fable that says, well, yeah, Friday is an unlucky day, 13 is an unlucky number, but they do not mention Friday the 13th. Friday the 13th probably came into usage in the early 1900s. There was a novel called Friday the 13th. There was a politician who did something really stupid, as politicians are wont to do, and the newspaper said, how dumb can you be? He did it on a Friday the 13th. So today we that kind of grew, and today we have all these legends about Friday the 13th. Now, there was this thing about Baphomet. Did the Templars worship Baphomet? And then here's a picture of the Sabbatic goat image. No, they didn't. This image wasn't drawn until the 1800s, okay, by an artist named Eliphas Levy. And Baphomet is a word that is in the trial transcripts of the Templars, but it was probably a misspelling of the word Muhammad. Muhammad, Mahomet. And again, these guys are being tortured and people are writing whatever they're going to write. So, Holy Grail. Were the Templars associated with the Holy Grail, the saint? Well, no. Holy Grail was fan fiction, okay? It was from a poem that was written in the 12th century that was not finished. It was Perceval, Le Comte du Graal by Chrétien de Troyes, all right? And where this Grail thing first, it wasn't even called the Grail in the poem. So, I'm going to tell you the French because it sounds really cool. It's sort of Hamilton. Okay, and then I'll tell you the English of what it is. So listen for the rhymes. Une demoiselle très belle et élancée et bien parée qui avec les valets venait tenait un graal entre ses mains. Quand on la salle, elle fut entrée avec le graal qu'elle tenait une si grande lumière en vain que les chandelles ont perdu leur clarté comme les étoiles qu'on se lève, soleil ou lune. Okay? Now, English. Doesn't rhyme as well, but it's cool. A beautiful girl, slender and well-dressed, came in with the servants, holding a grail in her hands. As she entered the room with the grail, which she held, such a great light came that the candles lost their brilliance, as do stars upon the rising of the moon or the sun. You can applaud now. Okay, all right, okay. Okay, so in this story, Comte du Graal, this character Perceval was advised to not speak, but he was later told that he would have asked whom the Grail served, it would have healed his injuries hosts, if anyone is, his host's injuries. Now, this story was unfinished, so everyone's like, well, we want to finish it. So for the next 50 years, people are writing these continuations of the story. So authors are continuing to write, and they're adding upon it, so they're expanding upon it. So what is this grail thing? So they're conflating it with other things. They conflate it with a cornucopia. They start calling the grail holy. They start speculating, does the grail have superpowers? Does it have healing powers? And then there's also this character Galahad coming in, who's from the Cistercian order, going back to Saint Bernard. And then the question comes up, who guards the grail? Well, who guards valuables? The Knights Templar. All right, so they're getting associated there with the grail. So Rosalind Chapel, is it associated with the Knights Templar? Well, you know, sure, there's symbols that are carved into it. You have symbols of two knights on a single horse. There's some Masonic imagery in it, and Freemasonry is coming in around 1700s. So there are some people, they weren't descended from the Templars, because the Templars had vows of piety, and they were not a separate race, okay? They weren't like aliens. They were people who came from various noble families, and sometimes someone who was of noble birth would set aside all of his belongings, and he would say, I am going to be a Templar for the next few years. And he would go in, he would take the vows of piety and chastity, he would fight, he would be a Templar, and then he would say, okay, I'm done, I'm retiring, and he would go back to being a normal citizen. He might have children. So if people said they were descended from Templars, sure, they might have a grandfather who was a Templar, they might have an uncle who was a Templar. It is possible for people to be associated with the Templars. So the Shroud of Turin, is it associated with the Templars? Yeah. So it was first publicly displayed in 1357. Who had it? It was the family of the grandson of Geoffrey de Charnay. The other guy who was burned at the stake was Jacques de Molay. And this shroud has been carbon dated. I know people may disagree with this, but when it was carbon dated, the results that came back is that the shroud was from a time period around 1260 to 1390, which would tie in with all this. It, again, these people were burned at the stake. The Templars did keep an eye out for what's called relics, Christian relics, anything that might be from Jesus Christ or anything that might be from a saint, so that they could not only protect them, but they could also carry them with them into battle. Because having one of these relics as you went into battle was said to give the forces of the battle extra powers, extra superpowers. Sorry, I'm being a little bit flippant, but they were always on the eye for relics. So it's very possible that something said to be a relic of Jesus Christ would come into the family of a Templar. Okay, so Prior of Sion. In reality, it was founded in 1956, okay, by a man named Pierre Plantard, who was a convicted con man, all right? Plantard was trying to say that there was this group named the Priory of Sion that had existed for centuries, and he even had family tree from ancient kings that went down to Pierre Plantard. It was all forged, but to Pierre Plantard, because he was trying to prove that he was the rightful king of France and that it should all go to him. So he created forged documents, and then he hid these documents in very clever ways. One way was he went to the Bibliothèque Nationale and he hid the documents in the archives, which you can do if you've been in libraries and you just go deep into the stacks. You know, you stick a paper in between a couple books, and you know, if the library's not really good on documents, it's going to show up. So he hid this one copy in the Bibliothèque Nationale. Another copy was planted in a book that was written about a mystery in the south of France. So this is going to get a little complicated, a little complex. All right. So this book is called Le Trésor Maudit de Rennes-le-Château, The Cursed Treasure of Rennes-le-Château. So what is Rennes-le-Château? It's a tiny village way, way, way in the south of France, which to them, to the French, is sort of their Roswell, okay? This is their Bermuda Triangle. This is their Loch Ness. Anything mysterious, goofy, alien-related that happens in France is probably related to Rennes-le-Château. This is their city of mystery. And it started becoming this in the 1950s. So a little bit more about Rennes-le-Château. Tiny village. I mean, if you've been to France, there's tiny, tiny villages. Population, about 110. All right. Now, in the 1800s, there was a priest there named Berger Saunier, and he came into a lot of money. This is true. Berger Saunier came into a lot of money, and so rumors are going, where did he get this money? Where did he get this money? And he used the money to launch building projects, construction projects all around the city, the village. But there's these rumors, where did he get the money? Where did he get the money? So now we fast forward to the 1950s, where there's a man named Noel Corbeau, who wants to open an inn in Rennes-le-Château. So he has the inn. He's not getting a lot of business. So if you have an inn or a bed and breakfast or something and you're not getting a lot of business and you're not that ethical, what do? You make up a story about a ghost or about a hidden treasure. And then you start getting people coming to your inn. Okay? So what he did is he took these earlier rumors about Father Saunière and he said that there was a buried treasure nearby. And that's where the money came from. So Pierre Plantard sort of latches on to this, okay? Now, he had decided to found this secret society, and he now fabricated medieval documents, some of which were hidden in the French National Library. That was Les Dossiers Secrets. And another set was planted in this book about Rennes-le-Château, the cursed treasure of Rennes-le-Château. And that book was written by Gérard de Sède. So in this book, it's now read by one of the tourists who comes to Rennes-le-Château, a man named Henry Lincoln, whose name you may know because he wrote some Doctor Who serials. All right, if you know that some of the Lost Ones, Abominable Snowmen, written by Henry Lincoln. Okay, so he reads the Web of Fear Dominators. So he reads this book, Le Trésor Maudit, in 1969, and he's thinking, hey, you know, I can do some stuff with this. And in this book, there is what looks like a medieval document. So again, this is a forged document planted by Pierre Plantard in this book. Henry Lincoln doesn't know it's a forged document. He thinks he's looking at a real document because the book says that Father Saunière, while renovating the church, had opened up a pillar and found some medieval documents. Here, we're reproducing the medieval documents in this book. But they're forged documents. Now, also in these medieval documents, I don't know if you can see, but there's certain letters that are raised just a little bit. Like in the top line, there's an A that's raised, and at the very end of the middle line, or that line, you see a D that's raised a little bit. So Henry Lincoln is really excited. He just found a code in this medieval document. You go through, and you get all these letters, and it says, A Dagobert de Roi et à Sion est ce trésor, et il est là mort. To King Dagobert II and to Sion does this treasure belong, and it is death, or, and he is there dead. Now, who is Dagobert II? He was a real king of the line of the Merovingians, which line had died out in the 7th century. So Henry Lincoln is like, wow, this is, you know, I write for TV. I can pitch this as a series of documentaries. So he goes back to England and he pitches it, and he gets to do a series of documentaries in England on the mysteries of Rennes-le-Château. So he's talking about these coded messages, and he goes on the lecture circuit, and he's talking about Dagobert. And while he's on the lecture circuit, he connects with a couple other people on the lecture circuit that are talking about Jesus and possibly a mystery involving Jesus. So we have these BBC Two documentaries about Rennes-le-Château in the 1970s, and Lincoln is also writing his own books, and he's giving his lectures and speculating on what secret that Priory of Sion could be. And as he's sitting in the hotel room and he's brainstorming with these other guys, Bajan and Lee, they're going, okay, Merovingian, you know, what's Merovingian? Well, if you go back and you find who's the first king of the Merovingian line, there's this old legend that he was born because his mom was swimming and she ran into a sea serpent and the sea serpent impregnated her, and that's where the first king of the Merovingian line came from. And they were like, okay. So this is Merowig from the late 5th century. And so as Lincoln and Bajan and Lee are trying to think about this, and they're saying Merovingians, okay, there's something fishy about the Merovingians, okay? All right, and then they say, they make the leap that fish links to Jesus Christ because of the sign of the fish that the early Christians used. And so they make the connection from there, okay, that, okay, so this means that Jesus is the treasure that's being guarded by the Priory of Sion, which is connected with the Knights Templar. okay. And so they write a book about it, which is Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So again, we're going to back up. So Father Saunier comes into a lot of money in Rennes-le-Château. Noel Corbeau uses those rumors to talk about a hidden treasure in Rennes-le-Château. Plantard and de Sed, Pierre Plantard, the con man, they publish Le Trésor Maudit with false documents in the book to confirm the treasure and tie it to the hoax of the Priory of Sion. And then Henry Lincoln, sci-fi writer, finds the Sion reference and starts creating his own books and documentaries about it. He connects with Bajan and Lee. They publish Holy Blood, Holy Grail, saying that the Priory of Sion is a fact because they've seen it in this medieval document. Okay? And then Dan Brown reads Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and he states in the front of his book that the Priory of Sion is a fact. But no, it's not. And 60 Minutes, the documentary, went in to the very back of it to the priest, Father Saunier. Where did his money come from? Had he found a hidden treasure? And no, he was selling indulgences. One franc and all your sins are forgiven. And so he had money coming in from everywhere, which he then used to fund building projects in the area. And there was a great quote from 60 Minutes and saying, Father Saunier's treasure did not come from some fabulous hidden treasure. It was good, old-fashioned fraud. All right. Thank you for staying with me through that very complex thing. So, a couple other urban legends. One is that there were European rumors that the Mongols had captured Jerusalem and were going to give it back to Europe. And this came from some documents that there was a rumor that the Mongols were in northern Jerusalem, and then some merchants get back to Europe and say they're probably in Jerusalem by now. And then the Pope is all excited and he declares a parade. And then also there were some documents where historians saw that the Mongols had attacked Jerusalem, and one of the Mongol generals was named Muley, M-U-L-A-Y, Muley. Well, the historians made the twist, oh, well, that general Muley must have been Jacques de Molay. And so now they're saying that the Knights Templar must have been there at Jerusalem. And so that's why you get this big painting at Versailles. Jacques de Molay takes Jerusalem, 1299, except it never happened. Okay? So there are modern Templar organizations. The actual Templars were disbanded in the early 1300s, but Freemasons and others were rising in the 1700s, and some of them incorporated Templar traditions into their own rituals. Ritual had to be in secret. And today, if you say, oh, it's Templars, and you go, well, Templars were gone in 1300, let's just forget about those 400 years. Let's overlook that gap, right? And so they're saying, well, the Templars were the ancestors of the Freemasons and going on from there. And there are Freemasons that claim great pride in saying that they are descendants of Templars. And they do use Templar traditions. We'll give them that. But there are some big gaps in the history. So these are just some of the modern Templar organizations and Freemasons. I've got a whole other talk about Freemasons. If you want to learn more about Templars, wonderful book to read is by Malcolm Barber. He wrote The New Knighthood, Trial of the Templars. This is the gold standard if you're doing research on the Templars. Helen Nicholson also has a great book, The Knights Templar, A New History. Now, if you're in a bookstore and you're looking for books about the Templar, take the book off the shelf, look at the back of it. If it says anything about space aliens, don't buy it. Anything about the Templars reconquering Jerusalem in 1300? No. Anything about Templars in charge of the Mongol army? No. Okay? So, these are facts. The Templars, they didn't have descendants, okay? They swore vows of chastity. But there were people who might have been Templars for a short period of time, like they were in the army for a few years and came out of the army, and then they had children. Sure, and someone can say, yeah, my dad was a Templar. No problem with that. They were not anti-Islam. They were not anti-Muslim. Some of the Templars, they spoke Arabic. Some of them had friends who were Muslim. But when you're in battle, you're in battle. You know, you got your enemy, you got your enemy. And they were not, repeat, not devil worshippers. These were trumped up charges by King Philip that he did to anyone who regarded as not pro-Philip. So, summary. Knights Templar were an organization during the Crusades from 1119 to 1312. They were the world's first multinational corporation, but they were arrested suddenly by a corrupt king on October 13, 1307, because he wanted their wealth for his own. They had a huge impact on modern culture. Think about if Microsoft suddenly disappeared, and everyone who ever worked for Microsoft was suddenly arrested and accused of crimes. And there would be like, what happened? What happened? What happened? And that would kind of lead to stories, and then more stories, and more stories. But with the Knights Templar, it's a compelling legend, and it keeps leading to new stories, with each new story building upon the last. Thank you. Any questions? Can we get the box? Speak into the box.
Sure. When was it revealed that the Priory of Sion was not real? Like, when did that come out, that it was fabricated?
There were definitely French newspapers around the time, because Plantard was arrested and put in jail. I couldn't give you an exact year. In America, I would say the 60 Minutes episode was probably the best indication of it, and that was, I think, 10 years ago. You can just look for Prior of Sion in Rennes-le-Château. Any other questions?
Thank you. You're talking about the assets being seized.
I'm sorry, talking about the
talking about their assets being seized as they were arrested. Uh-huh. If they had collected or were looking for relics that were important, what happened to all of those? Did France go ahead and take them? Where did they go?
They all got absorbed into another of the good question. They all got absorbed into another of the crusade orders, another order of monks, which was called the Knights Hospital, Hospitalet. I couldn't tell you specifically where the different relics went, but the Knights Hospital is an organization that still exists today.
Hi, if you wanted to visit some sites that were still around that were influenced by the Templars or where they used to live, what would those be and where are they located?
I would go research on the UNESCO World Heritage Site. Anytime I travel anywhere, I always check the UNESCO World Heritage Site to see if there's anything, because they're amazing. One is in Portugal. There is a round building. One is in London. The Temple Church is well worth visiting. They've got a lot of information about the Templars there. And if you ever go to Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, definitely visit the Temple Mount for whatever reason. The Wailing Wall is right there at the Temple Mount. The Dome of the Rock is there. Sometimes you can get into it, sometimes not. Also, there's a place where there's a hole in that rock where you can descend, and there's a little, tiny little cave under the rock. The Al-Aqsa Mosque, the farthest mosque, is definitely worth a visit. I have visited maybe half of those, personally. The Temple Church I've personally visited. I had a nice chat with the priest who was on one of the documentaries about Dan Brown. And so since I've been on one of the documentaries about Dan Brown, and he's been on one, we kind of had a nice chat. Yeah, we've both had characters named after us in Dan Brown's novels.
Okay. The forged document that took in Lincoln and his friends, how was that demonstrated or proven to be a forgery?
How was it proven to be a forgery? Well, there's no actual document that's ever been presented. The only place it's ever been mentioned is in that one book. It's never been mentioned in anything else ever. And the Priory of Sion is an organization where you can find the founding document, which was filed by Pierre Plomtard in 1956 in France. But it's a good question, though, because you have to think critically about these things. So, good question.
Have you ever heard of a rule of three, as in nine, will always come back to three?
A rule of three involved with the Knights Templar. I have not. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I just haven't heard of it. Any other questions? We have one over here. We got 8 minutes. Keep going.
Why the 400-year gap between the the Knights Templar disbanding and the Freemasons getting very interested in that?
Right. The Freemasons are not direct descendants of the Templar organization. It's that the Crusades ended in the 1300s. There were a few last gasp efforts, but effectively the Crusades ended. I think the Christians got finally kicked off the continent entirely. Cyprus, then they tried to take over one little island, and a few Templars got onto that one, and they held it, and then the Muslim forces kind of surrounded it, and then there was like, if you leave voluntarily, we'll let you go, and then people left voluntarily, and they were all slaughtered. So it's just then hundreds of years of other things happened. And in the 1700s, it's sort of a renaissance of thought started coming in, some of that which led to the formation of the United States. And one of those organizations was the Freemasons. And the Freemasons happened to incorporate Templar rituals into their own history. They could have adopted anything. Well, they did. They adopted some things about the building of the Temple of Solomon and other things to do with stonemason, but they liked the Templars and incorporated some of those. Next.
Are there any legitimate links between Sweden, the Swiss bank, and the Templars?
That's a really great question, because it said that some of the Templars fled to Switzerland, and then this great banking system came up that was in Switzerland, and people are going, maybe the Templars were the formation of it. I've never been able to find a link. I think it's just one of those things where there's dots, and because as humans we like to connect dots, and we go, oh, that's such a cool connection, but no, there's no connection that I've found. Good question.
I just wanted to know if you could go back to the page of the book recommendations, so I can copy. I wanted to know if you could go back to the page of the book recommendations, so we could get them all.
Oh, sorry, yes. Yeah. That one, yes? Okay. He caught the box.
Yeah, so when you were talking about the Pope and the King and they were seizing all the assets and arresting all the Templars, we talked about that the King really wanted their assets, but there seems to be, since he's working with the Pope, a lot. It seemed like it would be very easy to seize those assets. So what other motivations were there to arrest and persecute all of the other Templars besides just attaining wealth?
Well, there was also friction. Good question. There was also friction about Templars being able to pass through borders. Generally, monarchs wanted to tax anyone that was crossing a border. And so the Templars were just kind of everywhere. The Templars were also talking about creating their own state, their own nation at the time. One of the other orders was doing that. Sorry, I don't remember if there's any other historians. Feel free to call it out. But I think the Templars were thinking of forming their own nation state somewhere in the area of southern France. And so King Philip was definitely not in favor of that either.
Have there been any, can you think of any groups that were comparative to the Templars, you know? Were there anything that were near their scale or power from another culture, or were they just exponentially higher than anything at the time?
In terms of comparing in size, there were three groups, Knights Templar, Knights Hospital, and the Teutonic Knights? I don't remember. I would say the Templars and the Knights Hospital were definitely the largest. I don't have an exact size comparison, though. But it's a great question. I should probably include a slide on that. Bring the box.
Could you think, you were talking about the nation state before, could you be thinking about Malta and Knights Hospital?
Knights of Malta, that was the other one. I'm sorry, what was the question?
I'm just asking if that's the one you were thinking of for the nation state. Was it Malta and Knights Hospital? Because I thought they were in charge of Malta until they got taken out by the Muslims.
Yeah. Good. Yes, that answers that question. Thank you.
So why is it we hear so much more about Knights Templar and not Knights Hospital?
I would say because the Knights Templar have been used in more novels. I mean, the novel Ivanhoe really popularized the Knights Templar. I mean, he wrote this story, and it was sort of like Da Vinci Code. It just started getting taken to many, many different countries. Even though he'd taken liberties with the fact and fiction of it, Ivanhoe was just hugely popular. And then after Ivanhoe, we had other things that built on other things that built on other things, yeah. Any other questions? Okay, so I guess as a takeaway, it is to think critically about everything. And just because someone may tell you it is true does not necessarily mean it is true. Always do your own research on things. Always look for the truth. And thank you.